The Guardian.
Hello, this is Football Weekly from The Guardian. I am not James Richardson. He's skiing with his wife, who doesn't like skiing, apparently. You may know me from Sky's popular Saturday morning TV show Soccer AM, or perhaps BBC Radio Cambridgeshire in 2003, where I once did a report on Peterborough's oldest lamppost. I'm Max Rushton, by the way. Have I said that? Well, that's me. I'm Max. But we have a panel that you already know, all of you. Barry Glendenning is here.
Hello.
How are you? We've met before.
We have.
We spent an evening with Andy Gray.
We did.
Yes. Why is that funny?
No reason.
Okay, good. Sean Ingle, you're here.
Hello.
I've discovered today you're sort of important. You're like the boss. Are you the boss of everyone here?
Or? No. I'm only the internet boss.
The internet boss. Okay, and you've recovered from a mouth abscess.
I had something called Quinsy, which sounds vaguely sort of quaint and medieval, but it's actually a sort of big pussy abscess on one side of your throat. It's basically a acute form of tonsillitis.
Oh, right.
But it's luckily it's all right now.
Did you lance it?
No, apparently often you need it to be lanced with a long needle, but penicillin did the trick.
Okay.
And it sounds like an excitable TV pathologist who solves crimes.
Also with us, Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Producer Ben, we've never met.
No, we haven't. But
we met about 10 minutes ago.
That was pleasant.
It seems to be going all right. Ben tells me, the producer Ben, that you are known as the floating brain of football.
By James, yes.
Basically, right. He knows so much about football that we sort of present him as this giant brain in a tank simmering with fizzing synapses and electric currents.
So if the three of us are struggling, we just defer to Jonathan.
Yeah.
Okay, you happy with that? All right. Barry, talk to me about Leighton Orient Arsenal. Lots of people humorously saying Leighton Orient are better than Barcelona.
Well, on the evidence of last week, they clearly are. I mean, Leighton Orient are a good side. They hadn't lost at home since early September, and they've only lost once in their last 21 games, I think. So there was always a risk with Arsenal putting out a second-string team, and the team they put out was very much second-string, that Orient to get a result, and I don't think anyone would begrudge them that. Even Arsene Wenger didn't seem too annoyed about it afterwards, because while Arsenal do have a lot of fixtures coming up, I think there are four games in the next fortnight.
Yeah, they've got Stoke, Sunderland, the Carling Cup final against Birmingham, Orient and Barcelona.
Yeah, well, the one good thing for Arsenal, who will almost certainly win the replay at the Emirates, is that the game isn't until after they've finished with Barcelona. So, it's a brilliant result for Orient. I think they made a lot of friends yesterday, because just the atmosphere at the stadium seemed to be fantastic. And Barry Hearn and Russell Slade were both quite likeable blokes, or come across as quite likeable. And, fair play to them. They'll make a few quid out of it. And they've obviously, they're quite concerned at the moment with all this Olympic Stadium palaver, that they're going to be put out of business, because
West Ham
it's in their
down the road,
catchment area. But so it's good that they have a bit of good news.
Sean, you looked confused at one
point. No. I was just saying, afterwards, Arsene Wenger admitted that his team has a problem finishing off sides from lower leagues. But surely I think the problem is more of Arsenal's attitude. They seem to spend the first half almost doing the football equivalent of Prince Nassim Hamid, wiggling their hips a lot, throwing bolo punches, but without actually connecting with the opponent. And it was all very pretty, but it was only really when it went to 1-1, they just threw everything at Orient. And you kind of thought, well, if you had sort of done that after the first 10 minutes, you might well have been a couple of goals in front.
Orient are now going to get to go to Las Vegas. Barry Hearn has promised them this for their holidays. You've met Barry Hearn.
I have, yeah. I interviewed him right at the start of his Orient days. So, God, we're going back well over a decade. And he was telling me then about his big plan to make Orient the big club in the East End, which obviously hasn't materialised. But he was telling me also about his days in the early 70s when he had this young guy called Steve Davis who nobody knew, and snooker wasn't a big event. And they'd go up to these northern clubs with these big hard men and they'd play off money matches and snooker. And he said, I always had to go into the toilets and see if there was an exit, because it was always got a little bit fruit. And Davis, of course, was this brilliant teenager, win everything, and they just cleaned up.
And then get out of the fire escape.
And then basically get out of the fire escape, yeah. And I said to him, you must have met a few gangsters along the way. And he went, nah, gangsters are for movies. They're not there in real life. But they are, clearly are, obviously, but Barry was.
Are there clearly gangsters?
Well, I've seen enough of Crime Watch to...
Okay, no, this is true, I suppose. Jonathan, was there enough in that game? Because the rest of the FA Cup weekend was pretty boring, wasn't it?
I thought Chelsea-Everton was good. I'm glad for Everton because whenever I've seen them this season, they've always looked good. I don't understand why they're struggling as they are. I mean, I think they do lack a cutting edge, and Lewis Saha being injured clearly hasn't helped. But I think Baines has been great this season. I think Coleman's been great this season. Possibly Arteta hasn't quite returned to the form he had before the knee injury. But I'm glad for David Moyes having come under pressure that they do have a cup run. I mean, to the fifth round so far, but at least they are still in, at least they still do have something still to play for.
Was it more Everton being good or Chelsea being bad?
A bit of both, I think. I mean, Chelsea really have been struggling since what, October, November time. Torres coming in just seems to have complicated things because they now have two misfiring centre-forwards rather than just one.
I mean, that's a good point, isn't it? I mean, Didier Drogba's only scored four in 20 games and a lot of people have had a go at Torres. Rightly so, he hasn't played well, but fewer people have talked about Drogba. Or even indeed his attitude, which I thought was terrible on Saturday.
Well, the strange thing is that Anelka's probably the centre-forward in form at Chelsea, and yet he's the one who seems to have to miss out or go and play on the right.
I wonder why Chelsea aren't perhaps switching to 4-4-2 and trying, not the diamond, but going for width.
But who do they have to play wide right, though? I mean, they can play on the left, you can play Malouda, you can play Zhirkov, but they've got nobody on the right.
Six wins in all competitions since losing to Liverpool on the 7th of November, which is when Ray Wilkins left. Are Chelsea in crisis? Is he going to go?
I would be very surprised if he didn't go in the summer. I don't think he'll leave. There was a story in the Mirror today, I think, saying that he'll leave and go to Roma, where Claudio Ranieri has just resigned. But I don't see why any manager would leave a club like Chelsea when staying put and waiting to be fired guarantees you a giant payoff, which is like the reward for failure that football managers get these days.
I always think it can't be that stressful when you know you're going to get 5 million quid if you get sacked. If I was going to get 5 million quid for being sacked, I'd think about it.
You'd be even more incompetent.
Especially at a club like Chelsea, who now have a history of firing managers. I mean, apart from Mourinho, every manager who's failed to win the league under Abramovich has been sacked immediately. So given Chelsea aren't going to win the league this season, logically that means Ancelotti is going.
I should add, I don't consider Ancelotti a failure by any stretch of the imagination. He won the double last year.
Absolutely. He should be getting credit for that.
In Abramovich's eyes,
yeah,
what's happening at the moment is totally unacceptable.
But who comes in?
It's very difficult because they've gone through all the... if you're listing the best managers in the world, they've pretty much gone through them all. Yeah. Mm.
Andre Villas-Boas, the Porto manager?
Yeah, I mean, he's a possibility, certainly.
They've been great this season.
They have. Jurgen Klopp, maybe.
And it makes Tuesday against Copenhagen even bigger for Ancelotti. And Chelsea, that's the only thing they can win, isn't it?
I quite fancy Copenhagen to do a number on Chelsea.
Well, you were saying they were 5-1, which seems to me extraordinary. I think that's definitely value.
Yeah, the thing is, they haven't played a competitive match since early December because they've been on a 3-month winter break or something. So,
but I mean, it seems to it can go either way, whether they're rusty or fresh. I mean, if you look at, say, Shakhtar against Roma last week, the break seemed to have done them no harm at all. You look at Zenit in the Europa League and it seems to have done them all manner of harm.
Sean?
I was looking at the weather because I think we all famously remember when Chelsea went to Chomzo back in 96-97 and they lost 3-2 in the Arctic Circle. And
Copenhagen's not in the Arctic Circle.
Pun?
Copenhagen's not
still
in the
cold.
Arctic.
No, still cold.
I was looking at it's only -4 though. I was hoping it was -7 or 8 because there's a freeze across Europe at the moment. But you would imagine that Chelsea would win over two legs. But I think it could be very tight this first leg. Copenhagen play 4-5-1. They've drawn at home with Barcelona. Chelsea are short of confidence. They're short of width.
They're not just plucky minnows, game. Copenhagen, are they?
They're far from it.
Won the league like 100 years in a row.
Well, they're only 19 years old as a club.
Apart from that.
But apart from that, they've won it 100 years in a row. At the moment, they're 19 points clear at the halfway point of the season after 19 games. Their manager is technically dead.
He did die for like 6 minutes, didn't he?
Yeah. He died in 2001, I think it was, at a training session in FC Copenhagen. He was a player at the time, and he keeled over with a heart attack. And the rest of the players, like, there was no heartbeat, so after 6 or 7 minutes, they all went back to train or whatever and just left him there. And when the ambulance arrived, they were able to jumpstart him again. So
would put you off playing, wouldn't it? I guess if he'd been dead for 6 minutes. But it's given him like a sort of chilled out outlook on life, hasn't it?
Has it? I don't know.
I'm just going from the article I read yesterday in The Observer, which was very good.
Gronkia playing Chelsea, former Chelsea winger in an age when they desperately need wingers. And he sort of plays just off Damian Doyle.
Well, it's Gronkjær that got Chelsea where they are today, isn't
it? It is, yeah, that famous game against Liverpool. The only Greenland-born player ever to play in the Premier League, Jesper Gronkjær.
Oh, that's a good stat.
I mean, they've got to get in the top four as well, because the financial ramifications of this are very serious, especially with financial fair play coming in, that they're going to be struggling to meet the financial fair play targets anyway. But if they don't get in the Champions League, well, how do you then get the squad good enough to get in the Champions League again without massive investment? You make massive investment and you're falling further behind financial fair play. So, yeah, it becomes a vicious spiral for them. Spiral? Circle? Vicious. It becomes very vicious.
Something vicious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they really do need... I think it's more important for them to get in the top four. I mean, obviously, if they win the Champions League, they get in the Champions League again, but...
It's a shame. They've
got to focus on getting in the top four.
It's what everyone says about Spurs as well, isn't it? It's a real shame that actually it's more important that Spurs come fourth than do anything in the Champions League, people say.
Well, coming fourth in the Premier League for Spurs would be better than...
Winning the Champions League?
No, well... No, I don't think so. But finishing runners-up in the Champions League is no use to anyone, is it? If you don't qualify for the next season.
It just seems a shame that, you know, it should be about winning trophies.
Yeah, well, and that's why the FA Cup sort of diminished as well, isn't it? That it offers no great financial reward. I mean, it should be reward enough in itself, but modern football it's not.
So what do we think about the changes to the FA Cup proposals, seedings?
Seedings are a disgrace. You can't do that. It just ruins everything it stands for. You've made it a farce if you do that.
I mean, I've said this before, but I think it would be interesting if they offered a Champions League place for the Cup winners, because then that would change incentives. That would encourage teams to field their first 11. And it also mean that, you know, there's a chance for mid-ranking Premier League sides or even low league sides to have a year in the Champions League.
Does anyone know who decides that? Does the FA decide that? UEFA decide who goes into the Champions League?
It's the FA. But I had a lunch a while ago with someone very senior in UEFA who was talking about the possibility of maybe trying to get the cup thing in. But he said they
did pushed. Did you go somewhere posh for lunch?
No, he came into the Guardian.
Oh, okay.
The problem is, you know, the reason why the FA and the Premier League maybe, well, it's obvious why the Premier League would be against it. The reason the FA might be wary about it is if you, say, got Portsmouth getting into Champions League, they don't get through the qualifiers, and then England loses coefficient points, and then suddenly maybe there's only three places available, not four. And if one of those then go into the cup winners, then that coefficient's only going to keep...
I mean, to me, it's what makes the FA Cup exciting. And actually, I find the Champions League, the first stage of the Champions League, really, really boring. I know it would never happen, but I would love the European Cup to be like the FA Cup, and it's one leg, and you draw it out, and round one, Real Madrid, Man United, there you are.
Well, we've had this discussion many times in the pod before, and I'm sort of more on... I think the format of the Champions League is broken and could be improved. Others who come in here disagree emphatically, so...
So I think the format is fine, but the problem is with the economics of football and possibly the world. The format of 8 groups of 4... You know, gives everybody a chance to get through. It means that one slip up, you know, a key injury to a key player in one game doesn't actually mess you up. You have a chance to recover. It means you get, you know, 6 good games. Each team gets 6 good games each season. So they have a chance to derive revenue from that. But the problem is the disparity between the English, Spanish, Italian clubs on one side and the Eastern European teams on the other is so great that you get mismatches occur, and that's what makes it boring. It's not the format, it's the economic structure.
Quickly, Man United. They beat Crawley 1-0. It was sort of boring until the last 15 minutes.
No, I agree. I think the thing to take out of it is United's second string aren't yet up to the challenge of sort of taking over when the likes of Giggs and Scholes retire. I thought Obertan, I'm still waiting to see whether he's good enough. I don't think he is. BB's still very young, but he had a poor game. Gibson, Carrick, I don't think had much of a grip on midfield, and it wasn't a very good game.
The papers yesterday saying that Man United's midfield next season will be Jack Rodwell, and Luka Modric.
It would certainly work as a midfielder. The thing I don't get about Bebe is that United had the deal to sign Zoran Tosic and Adam Ljajic for 10 million combined. I think it was broken up as 2.8 and 7.2. And they didn't go through with the Ljajic part of the deal because apparently they couldn't afford the 7 million. They then pay 7 million for Bebe, and you look at Ljajic now, who's exactly the sort of player they need. He's playing brilliantly for Fiorentina. And you see, what on earth went wrong with that scouting? Like, how do they make that decision?
But isn't there a lot of luck? It's just a lot of luck in who you buy and then being a success.
But some luck, but I mean, I think Yeah, I mean, obviously Serbia's somewhere where I know a lot of journalists are saying, I know a lot of coaches are saying. Mm-hmm. They were all saying, why on earth have they bought Tosic? Lajic is a really good one. And the assumption was Tosic had been bought as a stalking horse for Lajic, that it was a package
deal.
Well, that, partly to have a mate there, but partly just Partizan didn't want to get rid of Lajic, but could take him as well, pay us a bit extra, just to kind of improve the deal from Partizan's point of view. And then, yeah, it was a huge shock in Serbia when United pulled out, because, you know, they see Lajic as being this, the future of Serbian football, and you know, what he's done in Fiorentina suggests he may well be.
Barry?
I agree. but I was always under the impression that the Bebe deal was like to grease the wheels for some other bit of business or other.
But £7 million of grease, it's a lot of grease.
All right, welcome to part two. And we're going to start by talking to Sid Lowe, our man in Spain. Sid, you're alive in Madrid airport.
I hope I'm alive, yeah.
What are you doing there? You're off to Lyon.
Yeah, I'm just about aboard a flight to Lyon, where, of course, Real Madrid play in the Champions League tomorrow night. And it's fair to say that there's a little bit of edge about this, because they haven't won a knockout tie in 6 years. They've faced Lyon six times and not beaten them. And I think this, in a way, is the real test for Mourinho. And I know we all bigged it up when it was the Clásico and said that was going to be the big test for Mourinho. And in a way, it was a test that he failed miserably with a final 5-0 defeat. But it's really about the Champions League for Real Madrid. So this is huge.
Who are favourites in this game?
I think Real Madrid have to be, just because of the quality of the squad, the fact that they've got Mourinho now. I know that they, you know, they're very conscious of the fact that Lyon are a side who've beaten them three times in France and drawn three times at the Santiago Bernabeu. But I think they believe that this year is different. Mind you, they fought that last year.
So why did Lyon keep beating them?
Well, I think the first couple of times, last year was slightly different. I think last year was to some extent fortunate. The first couple of times really were because Real Madrid weren't that good, and it was a very strong Lyon side, probably a better Lyon side than people gave them credit for. And as I say, the bottom line was that Madrid were not a great team. Last year was perhaps a little bit different. It was quite interesting reading an interview with Claude Puel this weekend, the Lyon manager, and talking about his tactical genius of the two half-time changes he made against Real Madrid last year. And he said, well, to be honest, it wasn't tactical genius. One player was injured. When we got into the dressing room, another player told me he couldn't continue, so I made the two changes and they got the goal, which sent them through on away goals. So I think it's why haven't Real Madrid got through beyond against Lyon before? I think it's a question more about Madrid than about Lyon, but without meaning that to sound like Lyon aren't a good side.
Sid, Jonathan Wilson, who's here with us.
Hello, Sid.
Hello.
He showed me a thing today from the newspaper AS, where they'd photoshopped a player out of a picture just to make a Barcelona goal look more offside than it actually was. Is this true?
It is true, and the most shocking thing is, in a way, it's not all that surprising. The bias of the media is absolutely extraordinary here. So in that sense, it's not surprising. It's not the first time that the evidence has been manipulated to try and prove things. Often you see the lines that are drawn on to show that players are onside or offside, and they're not drawn at all straight, and actually it slightly manipulates it. But I don't think I've ever seen a player disappear entirely from the photograph. AS have actually apologised for this. They've said that they're very sorry that it was a problem that happened in the process of changing a television image to a newspaper.
Well, just conveniently, they're just one person just disappeared.
Well, we reckon they should have said it was a Back to the Future thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, by messing with the past, one of the defenders has disappeared, and we need Michael J. Fox on a skateboard to rescue him.
That's awesome. In La Liga, Real and Barca won, sort of as you were, isn't it?
Sort of. I think mentally it's perhaps a little bit different. There's a feeling that Barcelona are slightly struggling, although of course they will take some heart from the fact that they were struggling last night and finally got away through. They really didn't play well. They played this revolutionary no formation at all formation last night, where they didn't seem to have a left back, they didn't really have a right back, they seemed to be all over the place, and frankly if they play like that against Arsenal will absolutely destroy them. Although that said, when I mentioned this last night, a few people said to me, you clearly didn't see the Leighton Orient game, so perhaps it's not necessarily as clear cut as that. I thought Barcelona were very poor for a lot of the game, but as they chased the game late on the last 15 minutes, saw some extraordinary things from Messi and Iniesta, and Alves played pretty well too. But as I say, the reason it's not as you were is that although it's 5 points at the top, I think mentally now Real Madrid are starting to think, whoa, hang on, there's a chance here, because Barcelona have wobbled in February, which they always do. Statistically, Pep Guardiola's sides have always had a worse February than any other month. So in that sense, perhaps it's altered slightly, yeah.
The big story you want to talk about... The Deportivo game, their keeper,
yeah,
scoring a goal.
And Yeah, Danny Aranfubia went up to score a goal in the 95th minute for Deportivo La Coruña. A really big one as well in the battle against relegation near the bottom of the table. And the reason that's significant is that Danny Aranfubia is their goalkeeper. He muscled out a couple of players and headed home in the 95th minute. And it's not just that it's a goalkeeper, because of course we've seen goalkeepers score goals before, but he's only the sixth goalkeeper in the whole of Spanish football history to score in La Liga. And most importantly, he's the first to score with a header, which of course is a roundabout sort of way of saying he's the first to score from open play. All of the others have been penalties or free kicks. So this has never happened before since La Liga first began in 1928, I think. So he's unique, and it was a fantastic scene. But what makes it so funny, really, in a way, is that this is Danny Aranfubia, and he said after the game, "Oh well, I just did what I watch my teammates do every week," and I just thought, "What are you talking about? Your teammates never score goals. They're the boringest team in the league."
How long till your flight?
I'm standing in a queue at the moment, but it's not moving very fast. The man's just come along to check that everyone's hand luggage isn't too big, and he didn't even look at mine, so I'm fairly confident I'm getting on.
Are you flying posh business class?
No, I'm flying EasyJet, of course.
And staying anywhere nice?
Well, I'm staying in Lyon. I don't know where it is. I think it was near the train station. Now, the area around the train station tends not to be particularly good, but I honestly don't know.
Sid, do we talk to you on a Thursday as well? That's good. We will find out exactly how your hotel was and what you had for dinner then.
Fantastic. I'll keep an eye on the food and make a note of it for you.
Good man. Thanks very much, Sid Lowe in Madrid. Fellas, what do we think about Mourinho? Do we think he's going to go if they don't get past Lyon?
Yeah, possibly. Whether he go now or whether he go at the end of the season. I mean, I think the fascinating thing at Real Madrid was you had the manager with the biggest ego in football, the president with the biggest ego in football, you know, the star player with the biggest ego in football, and Jorge Valdano, whose ego is not small, and all four together. And you know, the remarkable thing is it hasn't actually really kicked off yet. There's obviously a bit of friction between Valdano and Mourinho, but it hasn't quite gone as nuclear as it might have done. But defeat to Lyon possibly would ignite that.
Barry?
Well, I was watching the Real Madrid game over the weekend, and I noticed with Ronaldo, you know the way players have obviously planned or even practiced their goal celebrations. He seems to now have taken it to a new level by practicing and his poses for when he has a near miss. It's just astonishing. You know, his varying degrees of crestfallenness. I would be astonished if he hasn't been practicing them in front of the mirror.
I imagine he spends quite a lot of time in front of the mirror.
Just petulantly pouting and looking like, because it's all, he almost looks tearful when a chance goes narrowly wide.
How long can you spend in front of? I must admit, if I walk past a mirror, I'll have a look just to check. Yeah.
Well, when you look like I do, you spend as little time as possible looking in the mirror.
Right, very quickly into Bayern, Sean.
Well, I think it's repeat of last year's Champions League final. Inter have a brilliant home record in the Champions League. I think they've won the last seven games there. But Bayern, I saw them against Mainz at the weekend, and they were quite efficient, quite oppressive. And the last time these two teams played in the San Siro, Bayern in 2006, Bayern won, of course. So I'm really, really looking forward to this game. It might be, I think it's perhaps the tithe of the midweek, and that'll be one I'll be watching. But you, Jonathan, are you looking forward to it?
I am. I'm going to be in Romania, so I'm very much bound by what Romanian TV shows.
What are you doing in Romania?
It's the 25th anniversary of Steaua winning the European Cup this year, and it's also the 20th anniversary of Red Star winning the European Cup. So I'm going on a little trip to Bucharest, and then Sofia for the Sofia Derby on Saturday, and then Belgrade on Sunday for hopefully Poznański's first game as coach of Red Star. Although there remains a chance that might be moved for Saturday. And then mopping up old Romanian and old Serbian interviews.
Good stuff. Quickly, let's talk about Claudio Ranieri. He's gone from Roma. Are we all shocked about this?
Well, no, they'd lost. It's the fourth defeat in a row. They were 3-0 up against Genoa, and they lost 4-3. It's not a huge surprise. He's been on edge probably for half this season, and at war with Totti, and Roma slipping down the league. What, I think they're eighth, I think, at the moment. So it wasn't a huge shock.
Any English sides that might be interested in Ranieri?
Can't think of any off the top of my head, because Big Sam's still available. They don't need Ranieri.
Did you see that Sam Allardyce has got has forced Twitter to take down the Big Sam Twitter feed?
We had a tweet about this, actually. In part three, we'll have more tweets and questions. But someone said, so Sam Allardyce was so angry at the Big Sam, which was a fake Twitter account, that he's had it taken away.
Well, it didn't paint him in a very very nice light. I can understand why he might have been slightly annoyed.
It was one of the two best football spoof ones, though, wasn't it? That and literally Jamie.
Yeah, I thought the Big Sam was good. It went a bit OTT sometimes, a bit too below the
I did
bed,
have someone pretending to be me on Facebook once, which was quite exciting. And then I think they had more friends than I did, which was a little bit of a letdown. And then someone got in touch with me saying, do you realise there's someone who's pretending to be Max Rushton trying to pick up girls? I would have told them this was would not really help them in any particularly way, shape or form. But surely you've just got to have a sense of humour about that, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, well, it depends. Some people are thin-skinned.
But Big Sam's not thin-skinned, is he?
I saw on the ITV FA Cup highlights on, I think it was Saturday night, he was the resident pundit. He's been, you know, and they did a feature on him during his time in West Brom, and he got them promoted from one division to another. I can't remember which, in record time. You know, it's still a record to this day, I think, promoted in March, or had the championship won in March. But Sam was talking about how fond he was of his time at Notts County and how he learnt an awful lot, and it got me where I am today, he said, you know, which is unemployed, basically.
But maybe happy.
Yeah, but they showed him as well. I thought it was quite nice, you know, standing in the dugout during the game, puffing away on a cigarette. You don't see that anymore.
Cool, right, let's end part two on that Sam Allardyce anecdote. In part three, we'll talk Premier League and tweets and any other business. Welcome to part three. Barry has a story about TV.
Well, no, you were just saying that people on TV are nicer than people in radio.
Yeah, maybe.
And I said, no, you're better at faking sincerity.
Yeah.
Because, no, I've been on a couple of TV shows, and you go out and there's always a woman dressed in black with a clipboard, and she's very attractive. And she, would you like coffee? Would you like beer? Would you like food? Would you, you know, is everything okay? Did you find your way here? Would you like something to read? Blah, blah, blah. And then as soon as you go on, you do your bit. As soon as you're finished, right, sling it.
They take your clothes off you as well.
Pretty much. You know, oh, could you ring me a cab? No, can't, sorry. You know, because we're done with you.
Which shows? Can you name and shame these ones?
I'd rather not, just in case they have me back. Because TV is also quite well paid, as Sean, I'm sure you know.
I couldn't comment. Sean, you've been on telly. How did you find the experience?
Similar to Barry, I've done a sort of Sky, CNN, etc. They don't even big you up. When it's me, it's normally just in and out, and then off you go.
Barry gets obviously good service before. You don't even get that.
Well, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, my one and only gig with them, they were great. They not only paid well, but they taxi there, taxi back.
That's good.
And they sent me an email afterwards to sort of, you know, to say thank you.
What were you expecting afterwards, Barry? I'm scared to ask this question.
Well, I'm scared to answer it.
Should we talk about the Premier League?
It's just how abruptly they decide, well, you've served your purpose. We have no interest in what happens to you from this point on.
So, but they've got to move on with the show, haven't they?
And get your cab home afterwards. So
yeah, that is right. I think we get cabs home afterwards. I'd like to think so. Well, because we are based out in Austerlitz as well. I mean, we have to pay him a lot to get there, I imagine.
You probably have a soccerette. Give her a lift in your boot. Trussed up like a turkey.
I knew that was coming. Right, the Premier League. West Brom came from behind to draw 1-1 with Wolves. Roy Hodgson said it was a draw that felt like a win. Is that accurate from Roy?
Well, I think if you to lose a derby, you know, if you're in a relegation fight, you know, it's extra misery, isn't it? It's something else to sap from morale from the season. So to nick a late equaliser, yeah, it does give them a little boost. And having chucked away the 3-goal lead against West Ham in their previous game was probably very necessary. That was a draw that felt like a defeat.
But actually, what you really want is one of those to be a win, and it doesn't matter about the other one.
Well, you'd rather have a win and a defeat than two draws, because it's an extra point.
You'd rather have a win that feels like a win or feels like something completely different.
But I can see what he means. Psychologically, there is a bit of a boost there. I mean, it's interesting what happens for Hodgson, because the pattern has previously been that it takes time for his methods to have an effect. And certainly at Fulham, it took about 3 months before they started their upsurge when he took over there. Liverpool, maybe it would never have happened, but he certainly never had time for that to happen. I think it's going to be quite difficult for West Brom. I think there's going to be a few weeks of transition before you see the Hodgson tactics start to
Where do you stand on Hodgson? Because he has his apologists in the British press. There's some of the big name columnists that have said, you know, he's done a fantastic job, never really recognised in England for that, you know, until Fulham. And then you have others that basically say he knows the basics but can't really take a team on at the higher level.
Well, I mean, if you look back at the piece I wrote when he was appointed at Liverpool, I suggested the reasons why he might fail. It wasn't a surprise that he failed. I think his methods, it's all down to very hard work in the training field, quite boring, repetitive work. I remember talking to Simon Davis after the Shakhtar game last season, and him saying that it had actually taken a long time for Fulham players to accept it. Now, if it's taken a long time for Fulham players to accept it at a higher level, those players are going to be far more impatient because, you know, they think, well, they do know the game better. They're used to not having to do that in training. So I think that's possibly puts a natural limit on what he can achieve. I mean, he did an incredible job with Fulham. To take Fulham to the Europa League final is an astonishing achievement.
Beating Juve.
I mean, it wasn't an easy run to the final.
It seems very strange to me that there's this assumed logic that you're a manager who's only good enough to go so far. It's just not a Big Four manager. But you have to be given the chance to be a Big Four manager and given time, don't you?
That's the paradox of it, though, isn't it? It's very difficult to tell because Dennis Stewart, who served a long time on the Manchester City board and has been very successful in business after his playing career ended, he was making the point that if somebody's good at running a corner shop, all that means is he's good at running a corner shop. It doesn't mean you put him in charge of a multinational. And it's a similar thing. If you're good at working on a budget and lower levels, well, great, you're good at working on a budget at a lower level. So that doesn't mean you can take over a Chelsea or Manchester United where you suddenly got millions of pounds to spend.
But you have to be given the chance and you have to be given the time. And OK, Hodgson wasn't given the time, was he? How much time do you need to prove yourself as a manager?
I'm broadly in favour of managers being given more time. I think it's ludicrous that the average lifespan of a manager now, I think, is a year and 7 months. I know Sean's going to throw back Mourinho at Wenger, who won things in their first season. But if you look back, at Herbert Chapman at Arsenal took 5 years to win anything. Clough at Derby, his first year, they finished 18th in Division 2. Clough at Forest, they were struggling against relegation from Division 1. From Division 2 in his first season. So there is evidence that if you're going to build an empire, you need time. I think things have changed slightly because in the modern world, the disparity between top and the bottom of the league is so great that there's extra pressure to succeed, and it's more possible to succeed quickly with a bigger club just because you have much better players. But equally, sometimes when the manager and the club just isn't a fit, when everything's gone wrong, and I think that was the case with Hodgson at Liverpool, that to repair all the relationships that had broken there, it would have taken 3, 4, 5 years if it had happened at all. A similar thing with Sam Allardyce at Newcastle. I mean, I'm broadly speaking a fan of Sam Allardyce, but at Newcastle he'd very quickly ostracised the owner who hadn't appointed him, the board, the journalists, the fans and the team. Well, where do you go from there?
You're struggling then.
Yeah.
Barry, a couple of games this week in the Premier League, Blackpool Spurs. I think this is actually quite a big game for both those teams. I don't know if you sort of look at the fixtures and go, oh, it doesn't really matter because there's Champions League and Carling Cup next weekend and things. But you know, Spurs can go third if they win this game.
Yeah, and Blackpool are on the slide, so they need a good result. Actually, on the subject of Blackpool, and I know probably expecting me to talk about the game, but before the pod, Jonathan was telling me what I think is arguably the greatest football story I've ever heard, and it's about Blackpool.
No pressure then.
Blackpool goalkeeper Richard Kingston and his wedding shoes.
Right, talk to us.
During the World Cup, Ghana training, standing on the touchline with Neil Billingham, a journalist who at the time was working for FIFA. Richard Kingston gets a knock on his leg, so he comes over the touchline, he's sitting there with ice on his leg, he's chatting to us. He says, do you live in England? I just don't really know what to do. Maybe you can give us some advice. But I'm getting married in a month, and I was getting these shoes delivered from Italy, really nice Italian shoes for the wedding. And they say they've delivered them, but they haven't turned up. And I don't know, how do you track them? Do you go to the post office? What do you do? So Neil, who lives in Manchester, said, where do you live? And he names this village in Cheshire or somewhere. I assume Cheshire. And he goes, my brother lives there. What street do you live in? Says the street. Really? My brother lives there. It turns out his brother lives next door to Richard Kingston. So he then rings his brother and says, look, the same we've delivered these shoes. Yeah, these shoes delivered this morning. Well, can you have a look? Yeah, they're really shiny, nice, like Italian. The kind of shoes you wear for your wedding. You can just pop them in next door, can you?
That is a great story.
Do
we have a follow? I mean, can we get a picture of
Richard Kingston's shoes?
Yeah, at the wedding.
I don't know. What would we do with it on a pod?
We'd put it on the website. We'd tweet about it. I mean, you're right. It's a good point. Photos don't make the best part of a podcast, but I'd just quite like to know if he got them and if
he... Well, I assume he did. I mean, why would Neil's brothers steal the King's wedding shoes?
Well, I don't doubt the veracity of this story for a second. Why were Richard Kingston's shoes delivered to...
Cheshire.
Billingham's brother's house and not Richard Kingston's house?
I don't know. I think maybe he wasn't in, and so he just gave it next door to hand it over. I think that was what
happened. You can put a note on deliveries, you know, because I've just bought a flat and I'm not in a lot. So flat two, which is kind of an office, they get all the shelves delivered and I go around and pick them up. I've been told that doesn't endear me to listeners. What? That I have bought a flat? I mean, I'm 31. I'm quite late on buying a flat, to be honest. I don't think. Is that a bad thing?
I thought it was very vulgar.
Right.
Buying a flat.
Who do I think I am? You're right.
These recessionary times. Waving your
listeners' faces.
Sean, you were looking enthused by Blackpool Spurs.
Well, only because it'd be interesting to see how Blackpool get on. They've on a run. They've lost 8 of the last 10. They haven't managed to beat a top 5 side this season. But they're up against the Spurs side who are going to be without Rafael van der Vaart, who, you know, has clearly been fantastic this season. So, it'll be a really interesting game, I think.
Given what Spurs did at Sunderland, you think have they got the mettle to push on? They go third. How far can they go?
They can go second. I'll be honest, I was very disappointed with that Sunderland performance against Spurs. I thought Spurs would have one eye on the Milan game, and I thought Sunderland would have enough about them to beat them. And
Sunderland were very, very good for 20 minutes, and they got a bit carried away and started doing loads of back heels and let Spurs get back into it. But I mean, credit to Spurs not being blown away in that first 20 minutes. That's first 20 minutes is almost as good as I've seen Sunderland play ever, I think. Outstanding. That
you're a Sunderland fan?
Yeah.
On my list of questions for Jonathan W, it does say there was lots of debate after the live pod last week about Harry Redknapp's tactical acumen. What is your reading of the Milan game and how far will they go?
I think they'll beat Milan. League? I mean, I always thought they'd beat Milan just because I think Italian football tends to be very slow and ponderous these days, which isn't to say it's not good to watch. It's just when it comes up against football from Spain or England, it tends not to be able to compete just for pace. Also, the tendency in Italy is to play very narrow. The 4-3-1-2 is very typical the way Milan play. I think that's why Napoli are doing so well, because they play with wing-backs, so they actually have width that when the opposition full-backs come on, which is where they get width from, they're engaging the wing-backs on the halfway line rather than 30 yards from goal. So I think that gives Napoli a huge advantage. I mean, it depends very much who they draw in the quarter-final, I think, but they've got a great squad. I mean, I think losing van der Vaart, I think Spurs will cope, just because they can bring Nico Kranjčar in. I mean, Kranjčar's got a great goal at Sunderland. He's got a great goal against Bolton the previous week. He's barely played all season. I saw his dad was kicking off about that in the Croatian press over the weekend.
What did he say? You know, my son's the best.
Yeah, my Nico, he should be getting more of a chance. He's a lovely man's lad.
But that helped Palacios earlier in the season? Didn't Harry Redknapp
bump into Palacios? Is fantastic.
Palacios' mum in Waitrose or something. He said, play my son, and he did.
Really?
For 45 minutes, yeah, at some point in the season. I really hope I haven't just made that up.
But I mean, Palacios and Sandra, I thought, yeah, it was great, wasn't it? I mean, if you look at the goal that Spurs scored, it happened because Lennon was able to run at two exposed centre-backs. There was never a second in the game, even when Tottenham were piling forward in that first 20-25 minutes, when the two Spurs centre-backs were exposed, because Sandra and Palacios remained disciplined throughout.
And they are what, Spurs' second, third choice?
Well, I mean, maybe you'd say Palacios as a holding player would be the first choice. Maybe you play him ahead of Huddleston in a game like that. But yeah, by no means the obvious first choice pairing.
Here was a tweet from Red Ranter, who says, will Max Rushton play the clarinet on the pod as he claims he can in his bio? Producer Ben and I were chatting, and on Thursday, if I'm still employed for the podcast, I'll happily bring it in and play it for you.
You play the clarinet?
Yeah.
I saw somewhere...
To what standard?
I got grade 8 when I was little. I've not played it for a while, although I did... You know the singer Amy MacDonald?
Yes.
This is the life.
This is the life. She came on...
And this is the life.
Yeah. Yeah. And Love, presumably, you know, because she came on on Soccer AM and I said, there's no jazz clarinet on your album. And she went, well, you must come and play it on the next single. And so we all laugh politely because people say things and then they don't follow through with them, such as the way of TV, Barry.
Yes.
And then her manager rang up and said, look, do you want to actually do it? So I did it. You can say wow out loud, Sean, if you want.
did you get any royalties? Or
I didn't get any royalties. I was in the video, and then I played in Hammersmith Apollo in front of 5,000 people. Terrifying. You're looking at me like it's not
very,
true.
Very impressed.
I'm impressed. So,
yeah. I'm actually genuinely amazed that 5,000 people went to see Amy MacDonald in Hammersmith Apollo. Somewhere that Julian Clary, the comedian, described you as young and frisky, a cheerful, handsome man.
I used to do the breakfast show on BBC London and was fired because I wasn't famous and was replaced with Paul Ross.
Oh, God.
But, yeah, my co-presenter, Joe, was very good friends with Julian Clary. I once had lunch on her roof. This is not endearing me to listeners either, is it? But it's the truth. I can't help it. It was very strange. With Julian Clary and Vanessa Feltz. So, yeah, he's a nice bloke, actually. And there was one other tweet. I like this because I obviously quite excited about working for The Guardian. And within an hour of announcing I was working for The Guardian, Josh Evans tweeted me to say, any chance you could help me out with an assignment and give me your views on lowering the voting age to 16 would help me out enormously. How do you guys feel about the voting age in this country?
I don't care.
You presumably don't have a vote, do you? Or do you?
Why the hell wouldn't I have a vote?
Irish people
have
votes.
No, you do. That's that.
Yeah.
Irish would get a vote in our elections.
Yeah.
Well, you're a colony. I thought we'd given you it back.
Yeah, you have. Some of it. not all of it. Yes, I am allowed to vote. You make it sound like I shouldn't be given one because
like
I'm subhuman. You know, we'll have to give it to cattle and.
But like a French person living here, or a German person living here, wouldn't have a vote.
I don't know. Maybe
it's are you assimilated now? You're a passport. How long do you have to live here? Maybe
no.
I would never. You see, if I wanted to get a passport, I'd have to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen, and that just is not going to happen.
Okay.
Anytime.
But
ever.
It's a long-standing thing. I mean, my dad's Irish, and there was it's a long-standing thing that if you're Irish, you can vote in English elections.
Absolutely outrage!
I can't believe you don't know.
And I have.
I can't believe you don't work for the Daily Mail.
Give me money. I'll work for anybody. I'm not fussy.
I hope Jimbo's listening to this and getting really upset because we seem to be having a good time and it's going quite well. He'd be seething. He'd be really upset.
Take that as quite a compliment, but all this bit might be edited out. Remember.
I think you should leave it in. Don't come back, Jimbo.
Right, so that is the end. Will you have me back on Thursday?
I don't think it's our choice, sadly.
I think we're contractually obliged. Uber producer Matt has got you in. And
it's the longest contract I've ever had, I think. Two shows. Great. Jonathan, thanks for coming. Will you be here next Thursday? No,
I won't be, no.
You're out in Eastern Europe. Sean, you may be, Barry.
I think I am.
Yeah. Well, don't sound too excited.
Oh, I'm very excited.
Okay, good. Well, look, thanks for listening to this. Listen to us on Thursday, and then next week, James will be back and normal service will be resumed. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.